don't get in no trouble.
Nah, we're just trying to win this dance
club. You're staying alive on 101.9 with Marco on Astrotop.
We got the Refugees All Stars, Rubber Devin in the club, Y Clef Jean. Look at shorty got back. Should I ask her for a dance? Hold on, there's too many in the wolf pack. And besides, dirty cats talking to her, buying her fake furs and taking her to the fever.
Welcome, you're listening to CITR 101.9. It's Thursday, it's 3 o'clock, and it's time for another 1/2 hour of astronomy talk with your host Marco on CITR's Astro Talk.
Check the spelling REFUGE. Get the CD from Sam Goody. You ain't even close with the rhymes that you wrote. Don't be mad because you broke. Let me clear my throat.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9 FM.
Me. I'm eating mangoes in Trinidad with attorneys. Yeah. My food slang flow worldwide like a current. Went to every spot where nobody got insurance. Rubber do the math, you ain't half exotic. My man's claim true, you forget about it. Ho-ho, just a new sense, like my influence. Well recognized, you a lie trying to do it. Got you, told your lady, oops, we nuts, baby. Smooth and charismatic, automatic, you gon' save me. God bless the dead as my son survived. We strive to teach you, baby, and stay alive and alive.
Welcome. This is Marco. Now we're back. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Last night I was reading about what women did in the early years of astronomy in the early 1900s. There's a photo here of rocket girls, they're called, and they were the human computers. They didn't have computers, so these women would do the messy calculations. A lot of hard work. And one of them, Henrietta, I think Swan, please forgive me, I don't remember her name, her last name, but she did some work on standard candles. So before the standard candles, it was difficult sometimes to get a distance of something far off, a galaxy or something that was really far away. So I think she did on stars, she did standard candles, so the astronomers could use a standard candle. I think the reasoning was a certain type of star would be as bright here as any other galaxy. So if you saw that same kind of star in another galaxy, then you could tell from its faintness or its luminosity how far it was. So she did important work on that. And Henrietta Leavitt, maybe, sorry. She did important work, and it allowed Edwin Hubble to do his calculations on the expansion of the universe. So truly groundbreaking work. And she wasn't supposed to. She was just supposed to be a human calculator, but she took all this, all the data in front of her, worked with it, and discovered important things. There was also Jocelyn Bell, who received some of the was the first to find out about pulsars, and she wasn't awarded with a Nobel Prize. So a lot of people thought that was fishy because the other people working with her were. So she should have gotten a Nobel Prize in physics or astronomy, but she didn't. And at first they thought these pulses from outer space were signals from little green men. I think they called them LGM pulses because they thought it was a signal from another civilization, but it was really just a neutron star sending out radio waves at regular intervals. So Jocelyn Bell did that. And here I have a photo of the rocket girls in the earliest days. I'll read the article. In the earliest days of space exploration, most calculations for early space missions were done by human computers. And most of these human computers were women. These women's calculation helped the U.S. launch its first satellite, Explorer 1. So there's a photo here of them in 1953 at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And it was a photo of a lovely lady. She was the first African-American hired at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Her name was Janice Lawson. She was a graduate with a degree in chemical engineering. After her career at NASA, she went on to have a successful career as a chemical engineer. So there's a lot of people, a lot of ladies that didn't get the recognition that they should have. I think one of them I was reading last night, Annie Jump Cannon. She was partially deaf throughout her career, but she still did stellar work on, I believe, Stellar Evolution and stuff. So there's a page on my website. Yes, my website is finally finished. I did a website with GoDaddy, and then they deleted it because they said I didn't pay. And they had my credit card, but they still deleted it. So I just built a new one the past few weeks, and it looks very nice. Better than before. Better than GoDaddy's. So it's www.marcosastrotalk.com. That's my website now. So I love it. It's beautiful, and you can go listen to it. So let's read about the Rocket Girls. In the earliest days of space, in the earliest days of space exploration, most calculations for early space missions were done by human computers, and most of these computers were women. These women's calculation helped the U.S. launch its first satellite, Explorer 1. This image from 1953, 5 years before the launch of Explorer 1, shows some of these women on the campus of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, in Pasadena, California. So this article can be found on www.nasa.gov, which is, of course, my favorite website. And the article is dated January 31st, 2018. And the name of the article is Rocket Girls and the Advent of the Space Age. So once again, Rocket Girls and the Advent of the Space Age. So I'm going to keep reading the article. JPL's, which is the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, human computers didn't just help launch the space program. They also represented an important step forward for women and other underrepresented people at a time when much of the professional world, and especially technical fields, were dominated by white men. Janice Lawrence, seen in this photo, was the first African-American hired into a technical position at JPL. Having graduated from UCLA with a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering, she later went on to have a successful career as a chemical engineer. Explorer 1 successfully launched from Cape Canaveral's Pad 26 on January 31, 1958, the day my sister was born. The image of Jet Propulsion Laboratory's human computer shows women, black and white, young and old, whose work helped propel this nation into the space station, and they did so by hand. So they did all these calculations by hand. That was quite amazing, wasn't it? So these are called the Rocket Girls. So again, the article is called Rocket Girls and the Advent of the Space Age. It's on www.nasa.gov, January 31st, 2018. And it's under the section of Explorer/Early Satellites. And again, it's called Rocket Girls and the Advent of the Space Age. So I was reading about Annie Jump Cannon a bit last night, and she was, believe she was partially deaf or almost fully deaf. She was like this throughout her career. Okay, so now here's another article dated November 2nd, 2016, and the article is dated When Computers Were Human. So there's a photo of a lady here sitting at a desk, and it says, computers weren't always made of motherboards and CPUs. At one time, they were human, and at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, human computers were a talented team of women who went on to become some of the earliest computer programmers. In this photo from 1959, a human computer works with an early machine computer called the IBM 704. While machine computers were capable of some speedy calculations, they weren't nearly as reliable or efficient as humans. So it shows a woman sitting at a desk at one of these IBM 704s. Okay, so in the news, here's the article. I'm going to read it now. In the news, this week we celebrate the 80th anniversary of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That was on November 2nd, 2016. So now it's 2 years, almost 2 years, year and a half after. JPL was founded long before it became NASA's premier center for robotic exploration of the solar system, and even before the agency existed. In fact, JPL started as a testbed for some of the earliest rocketry experiments, thus the name Jet Propulsion Laboratory. There were a number of factors that conspired to change JPL's focus from rocketry to space exploration. The space race and the resulting formation of NASA were two major factors. But also, with its growing expertise in launching rockets to new heights, JPL was anxious to take its experiments even farther. So in 1957, when the Soviet Union won the first leg of the space race by placing Sputnik, the first artificial satellite, into Earth orbit, JPL was called into action. A few months later, NASA launched the JPL-built Explorer 1, which became the first U.S. satellite. Soon, the challenge was to land on the moon, and JPL was once called to the task. So landing on another planetary body had never been accomplished, so understandably, it took a few tries to get things right. So the first few tries with Rangers 1 through 6 all failed for various reasons. Some of these spacecraft from Rangers 1 to 6 flew very near the moon, only to miss it by a few hundred kilometers. Others met their mark, only to have onboard cameras fail. Ranger 7 was the first mission to successfully land on the moon and transmit data. Capturing images 1,000 times better than those obtained by ground-based telescopes. It wasn't a particularly soft landing. Rather, it was a purposeful crash landing, capturing images along the way. But everyone at JPL was thrilled to have hit their target and returned usable data. These data and those collected by subsequent missions made possible NASA's later human missions to the moon. At the same time it was launching the Ranger lunar missions, JPL had its sight set on launching a series of missions farther into space called Mariner to Venus, Mercury, and Mars. It wasn't long before JPL's specialty became creating robotic spacecraft to go not to just the moon, but also where no one had gone before. And there's a nice video here on JPL's history. So this is when computers were human on NASA.gov, and it's dated November 2nd, 2016. And how they did it, what's often not known is all. So here's a photo. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 ladies sitting at a desk. And the article or the caption under the picture is a talented team of women who were around since JPL's beginnings in 1936 and who were known as computers were responsible for the ongoing number crunching of launch windows, trajectories, fuel consumption, and other details that helped make the U.S. space program a success. So here's the article. It's the same part of the article, but here's the heading, how they did it. What's often not known is all the early rocket experiments and later missions to the moon and beyond wouldn't have been possible without a team at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, known as the human computers. Most of these human computers were women who had either degrees in mathematics or were simply very good at mathematics. Over the course of time, these women not only performed hundreds of thousands of mathematical calculations crucial to the U.S. space program, but also eventually became some of the first computer programmers at NASA. In the early days of space exploration, the best mechanical computers were large, the size of a room, and not particularly powerful. Human capabilities were much more powerful for many tasks, including the rapid calculations needed for trajectory analysis and verification, as well as the graphing of data points on trajectories, which made a spacecraft pass easy to see. One of the human computer's main tasks was computing the planned trajectories or paths for a spacecraft based on the vehicle weight, lift capacity of the rocket, and the orbital dynamics of the planets. When a spacecraft is launched, it begins sending telemetry signals back to Earth. These signals tell engineers information about the spacecraft's location and the spacecraft's health. But this information isn't perfectly straightforward. It arrives as a bunch of numbers that need to be combined in formulas along with other constantly changing parameters, such as velocity, vehicle mass, and the effect of gravity from nearby bodies, in order to reveal the spacecraft's actual location. before there were computers as we know them today to do these calculations, human computers, which were the women, would feverishly calculate the exact location of the spacecraft as the telemetry came in and compare that to the planned trajectories. Their calculations would reveal whether the spacecraft was on target. So now we take for granted we have a computer age, a computer world, and everything is run by computers nearly. And if something fails, like here at CITR, we don't know what to do. The computers run everything. So before the women did all the calculations, and like I said, they feverishly did them on the spot, online at the time, because these data were needed right then and there. So they needed the data prompt, and the women did a wonderful job of doing that. So I guess we can sit back and think how far we've gone. We can launch so many rockets and Hubble space telescopes, so many things, a few vehicles on orbit around Moon. The Cassini mission just ended in Saturn. The Juno mission is still in Pluto. The New Horizon mission went by, no, sorry. The Juno mission is in Jupiter. Correct that. I'm sorry, I said Pluto. So the New Horizons mission is in Jupiter. It's in orbit around Jupiter, and there's another story about that right now. So, and New Horizons is one that went by Pluto a couple of years ago, and it's on the way to an asteroid or a dwarf planet or some kind of object, MU something like MU1669. So it's more than halfway there from Pluto, and it eclipsed the star last summer, I think. So imagine all the computers we have. We can detect gravitational waves now. And there's so much technical capabilities. New spacecrafts are coming online, new observatories. So we're quite advanced in terms of before. And doing the calculations required to get Explorer 1 into orbit was no small task. Calculating the trajectory for a Ranger crash landing or a Surveyor soft landing on the moon was even more challenging. Once humans were destined to be on board for the Apollo missions, the stakes were even higher. Fortunately, JPL had set the stage of developing the techniques and calculations necessary to land a robotic spacecraft safely on the moon. So some of these things, people say, well, why are we wasting money going to space? Well, there's a lot of spin-offs. And it's sad to say, but I believe in World War II, the rockets that were launched in the spacecraft later, we used that technology to have jets. So there's lots of spin-offs, even from war, which is too bad. War. Anyway, now there's another heading in the article, say why it's important. Today, JPL continues setting the pace for exploration of the solar system using robots to go where humans hope to venture one day, such as Mars. Though trajectory computations are now done using modern-day computers, humans are still required to do trajectory analysis and mission planning. Every mission is different, and with new techniques comes new simulation equations that must be developed and computations that must be performed during actual mission events to ensure success. But even now, nothing is fail-proof. Lots of variables can and do influence space flight. Arriving safely on another planet millions of miles away isn't easy or taken for granted. But when things go right and we achieve a safe landing, it is definitely cause for celebration. When launching to another planet, we want to take the most efficient route using the least amount of rocket fuel possible. The early human computers quickly discovered that launching when two planets are closest and using a lot of rocket fuel for the job isn't the best plan. Use this fascinating bit of history as a real-world advanced algebra and physics lesson with students in this standard aligned activity that has grade 9s to 12 calculate the next launch windows to Mars. So there's a lesson. It says here, go to the lesson. So I'm going to go to the lesson. So when is the next launch window to Mars? It's here on www.jpl.nasa.gov/edu/teach/activity/. So it shows a spacecraft leaving Earth, getting to Mars, and on the way back, it didn't show on the way back. It just shows what is the best trajectory for the spacecraft. So that was a good article. It talked about the women's early contribution to the to space science. So now I am going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy. This morning I woke up, and there was a beautiful little sliver of a moon on the, I guess you can say, east, southeast, a bit above the horizon, and I was too lazy to take my telescope out, and it was cold. I took my binoculars, but couldn't see much. So maybe tomorrow morning, if I see it, I might take my telescope, but it was a bit cold outside. Okay, so anyway, I'll be back in a few minutes. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
It's from the Gucci in the winter. I see you with your girl. In your chinchilla fur, I was laid up in the cool back shader. Looking at your face just pure with no makeup. A little bit of MAC lip gloss. Hair in a bun, well done. Looking for a ring, I see none. So I hopped out the coupe and hot the suit to stop and introduce like I'm shining. You my destiny. In your diamond cluster, too much just to touch you.
This is Robin, the program manager at CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco, the best astronomy program on the planet.
Put it in your purse and call.
On the telephone, she heard my voice. Tell me to pick her up in my Rolls Royce. If my Rolls Royce is not for ladies, then girl, I'm gonna take you in my Mercedes. If my Mercedes would get full of the disease.
My player days is over. Well, maybe not completely, but still in all. Come here, rest your head on my bed. And let me get between your legs. Lay on your back, take it from the back. Like a bag you're supposed to. I know you like that.
Welcome back. That was Shine from... That was Shine from Shine. So, thank you, Robin, our previous program manager. So we're back, and we're talking about women in astronomy. And... there is this astronomer whose name was Annie Jump Cannon. I don't know why they called her Jump, but she passed away in April 13th, 1941, was born in 1863. She was an American astronomer whose cataloging work was instrumental in the development of contemporary stellar classification. So when we have to think about this, there's a... I guess it's called a Russell-Hertzberg diagram. I think I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. But there is a diagram which shows that's a kind of a curved line. It's the main sequence. It's where most stars are. And then there's other lines, other spots on this diagram. I think this is another type of classification system. And it shows when the stars go off the main sequence, like when they become red giants, which our star will maybe in 5 billion years or 6 billion years or so. So she was instrumental in developing this classification system for classifying stars. So she was with Edward C. Pickering. She is credited with the creation of the Harvard Classification Scheme, which was the first serious attempt to organize and classify stars based on their temperatures and spectral types. She was nearly deaf throughout her career. So she was born December 11th, 1863, and she went to a place called Wilmington Conference Academy, which is today known as Wesley College. She was a promising student, particularly in mathematics. And in 1880, she was sent to the Wellesley College in Massachusetts, one of the top academic schools for women in the U.S., where she studied physics and astronomy. She studied under Sarah Frances Whiting, one of the few women physicists in the United States at that time, and went on to become the valedictorian at Wellesley College. She graduated with a degree in physics in 1884 and returned home for a decade. Soon afterward, she was stricken with scarlet fever that rendered her nearly deaf. So in 1896, she became a member of Pickering's Women, a group of women hired by Harvard Observatory and director Edward C. Pickering to complete the Henry Draper catalog with the goal of mapping and defining every star in the sky to a photographic magnitude of about 9. So there's a magnitude system for stars. Sometimes I can't understand it. Maybe I should take some time to remember it. Sometimes I look out over it and then I forget it. So anyway, there's a certain classification system and it's confusing. So in her notes, she referred to brightness as INT, which was short for intensity. Pickering said that she wanted to classify stars quickly. And this is Pickering's quote: "Miss Cannon is the only person in the world, man or woman, who can do this work so quickly," end quote. So there was a Draper catalog, and soon after they started trying to make a Draper catalog, a disagreement developed as to how to classify the stars. The analysis was first started by Nettie Farrer, who left a few months later. She left the problem to the idea of Henry Draper's niece, who is Antonia Maury, who insisted on a complex classification system, and Wilhelmina Fleming, who was overseeing the project and wanted a much more simple, straightforward approach. So Annie Jump Cannon negotiated a compromise. She started by examining the bright southern hemisphere stars. To these stars, she applied a third system, a division of stars into the spectral classes O, B, A, F, G, K, M. And I've seen those before. Don't remember what they are now. But anyway, her scheme was based on the strength of the Balmer absorption lines. So I believe that the Balmer absorption lines are the four lines. They're visible lines in atomic physics, and they describe the spectral line emissions of the hydrogen atom. So there's other lines in the hydrogen system, and this is when atoms jump from one level to another level. And the person who discovered this was John Balmer in 1885, Johann Balmer. He was a teacher at a all-girls school. He was teaching math. So the visible spectrum of light from hydrogen displays four wavelengths: 410 nanometers, 434 nanometers, 486 nanometers, and 656 nanometers. So I'll do that again. 410 nanometers looks purple. 434 nanometers looks blue. 486 nanometers look light, kind of aqua blue, like the San Jose Sharks uniform. And 656 look kind of reddish. So these are prominent hydrogen emission lines. That's when electron, it transits. It does a quantum leap. It jumps from one energy level to the next, down to the next. And when it does that, it emits a particular wavelength of light, which corresponds to a certain color. So there's a photon that jumps. The electron jumps, but when it jumps, its reduction is energy is emitted as a photon of a certain color. And the ones that are the visible are described by the principal quantum number n equals 2. There are several prominent ultraviolet Balmer lines with wavelengths shorter than 400 nanometers that the human eye cannot see. the number of these lines is an infinite continuum as approaches a limit of 364.6 nanometers in the ultraviolet. So the Balmer series is characterized by an electron jumping from an energy level higher than 2, for example 3, 4, or 5, to the energy level 2. N is the radial quantum number or principal quantum number of the electron. There is a transition from N equals 3 to N equals 2. So that is the third energy level to the second energy level. It's called H alpha. The transition from the fourth energy level to the second energy is called H beta. The transition from the fifth energy level to the second is called H gamma. And the transition of an electron when it jumps from energy level 6 to energy level 2, I think it's called H omega. I think it's omega because these are capitalized or not capitalized, so I'm not sure about this, the last one, omega. So they are in the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So again, for example, if an electron jumps from energy level 6, so the energy levels in an hydrogen atom are like the circular paths of the planets in our solar system. So the sun is the nucleus, and what happens is the electrons jump down. And when they jump down, they emit a certain wavelength of light, and we can see them. These are the four visible hydrogen emission spectrum lines. So she did her classifications based on, you know what, I got a lot of windows open, so you're going to have to give me a second, because I'm going to try to find where I started from. Okay, hang on. I opened too many windows. So let's see if I can find Annie Jump Cannon. There we go. I found her. Okay, so she started her experiment on classifying stars by examining the bright southern hemisphere stars. So to these bright southern hemisphere stars, she applied a third system, a division of stars into the spectral classes. These are capitalized, either O, B, A, F, G, K, M. Her scheme was based on the strength of the Balmer absorption lines. After absorption lines were understood, after absorption lines were understood in terms of stellar temperatures, her initial classification system was rearranged to avoid having to update star catalogs. Astronomy students are taught to use a mnemonic, "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me," as a way to remember Stellifer classification. So it's O, B, A, F, G, K, M, which is "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me." So that's the, I don't know if people like that classification, but that's what I've heard before too. Annie Jump Cannon published her first catalog of stellar spectra in 1901. In 1911, she was made the curator of astronomical photographs at Harvard. In 1914, she was admitted as an honorary member of the Royal Astronomical Society. In 1921, she became one of the first women to receive an honorary doctorate from a European university when she was awarded an honorary doctor's degree in math and astronomy from Groningen University. Cannon and the other women at the observatory were first criticized for being out of their place and not being housewives. Women did not commonly rise beyond the level of assistant in this line of work at the time, and many were paid only 25 cents an hour to work 7 hours a day, 6 days a week. Not much money. Cannon dominated this field because of her tidiness and patience for the tedious work, and even helped the men in the observatory gain popularity. Cannon helped broker partnerships and exchanges of equipment between men in the international community and assumed an ambassador-like role outside of it. She wrote books and articles to increase astronomy status, and in 1933, she represented professional women at the World's Fair in Chicago. Cannon manually classified more stars in a lifetime than anyone else, with a total of about 350,000 stars. Now, isn't that amazing? She discovered 300 variable stars, 5 novas, and 1 spectroscopic binary, creating a bibliography that included about 200,000 references. She discovered her first star in 1898, though she was not able to confirm it until 1905. When she first started cataloging the stars, she was able to classify 1,000 stars in 3 years, but by 1913, she was able to work on 200 stars an hour. Cannon could classify 3 stars a minute just by looking at the spectral patterns and, if using a magnifying glass, could classify stars down to the 9th magnitude, around 16 times fainter than the human eye can see. Her work was also highly accurate. So there's a way to catalogize stars based on their brightness and their temperature, and this all works in the diagram. I'm sure other people have worked on this diagram. I thought it was called the Russell-Hertzsprung diagram, and she maybe did another one. So on May 9, 1922, the International Astronomical Union passed the resolution to formally adopt Cannon's stellar for classification system. With only minor changes, it is still being used for classification today. Also in 1922, Cannon spent 6 months in Arequipa, Peru, to photograph stars in the southern hemisphere. Now I tell you, it seemed this Annie Jump Cannon had a real passion for astronomy. You know what a lot of us do, and it's amazing when you have a passion for something, and astronomy is just a great hobby, a great lifetime. You could spend your life. For example, one person told me for 1 year of his life, every night that he could, anyway, this is Vancouver, he would look at the moon through his telescope and learn all he could about the moon. He did that for 1 year. So imagine how big the universe is, how you can spend so much time with advances. So back to the article. In 1925, she became the first woman to receive an honorary doctorate of science from Oxford University. In 1935, she created the Annie J. Cannon Prize for the women of any country whose contributions to the science of astronomy are the most distinguished. She became the William C. Bond Ambassador at Harvard University in 1938. The astronomer Cecilia Payne corroborated with Cannon and used Cannon data to show that the stars were comprised mainly of hydrogen and helium. Later life and death. Annie Jump Cannon's career in astronomy lasted for more than 40 years until her retirement in 1940. Despite her retirement, she continued to actively work on astronomy in the observatory up until a few weeks before she died. During her career, Cannon helped women gain acceptance and respect within the scientific community. Her calm and hardworking attitude and demeanor helped her gain respect throughout her lifetime and paved the path for future women astronomers. Cannon died on April 13, 1941, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the age of 77. She died in hospital after being ill for over a month. The American Astronomical Society presents the Annie Jump Cannon Award annually to female astronomers for distinguished work in astronomy. So what a scientist, what a wonderful person. This are her awards. 1921, honorary doctorate from the University of Groningen in Netherlands. 1925, first woman recipient of an honorary doctorate from Oxford University. 1929, chosen as one of the greatest living American women by the League of Women Voters. 1931, first woman to receive the Henry Draper Medal. 1932, won the Ellen Richards Prize from the Association to Aid Scientific Research by Women. 1935, received an honorary degree from Oglethorpe University. First woman elected as officer of the American Astronomical Society. The lunar crater Cannon is named after her. The asteroid 1120 Cannonia is named after her. She was nicknamed as Census Taker of the Sky for classifying, I think, 350 stellar bodies more than any other person. The Annie J. Cannon Award in Astronomy is named in her honor, awarded since 1934, now annually to a woman astronomer in North America. And there's so many other things, but I'm just going to read one more. Cannon Hall, a residence dormitory at the University of Delaware, is named in her honor. So she did amazing work. And guess what? She was sick, I believe, which year was it? Somewhere here. But then she lost most of her hearing, but she still continued her great work. So she classified more stars than anybody else. And remember, she was a pioneer. It's not just that she did this stuff as, okay, someone else did the groundwork, but she actually was a pioneer in this. So when we come back, let's look at more work on women in astronomy. So please stay tuned. I'm going to go to a commercial, and when we do, we're going to talk more astronomy. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Disability doesn't make you exceptional, but questioning what you think you know about it does.
Accessibility, disability, mental health, ADHD, ADD, and many more topics we explore and cover.
But on where, you say?
It's CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively blend show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in DC and around the world.
Catch us every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 5.
If you want more info or to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
You're back with Marco on Astro Talk on CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9 with Marco. So, I'm having a fascinating time today, learning all about contributions that women have made in the science of astronomy. So I talked about Annie Jump Cannon, and I didn't know she did all this amazing work. And remember, when astronomers were in those years before us, it was groundbreaking work. There had nothing to fall back on. So maybe people paved the road for some of these with their research, but she took off and she did all this. She created all this stuff. So she was quite amazing. This was Annie Jump Cannon. Again, I don't know why she was called Jump Cannon. But anyway, there's another one that I know more about. Her name is Henrietta Swan Leavitt. And she was born July 4th, 1968, and passed away December 12, 1921. She was an American astronomer who discovered the relation between the luminosity and the period of Cepheid variable stars. So this helped Hubble with his theories, and without this groundbreaking work, Hubble could not have made his breakthroughs. So again, she was a human computer. She was doing calculations, and with all this data in front of her, she was not expected, or she was not asked to do this other science. She was just, her duty was, I believe it was 25 cents an hour, 7 hours a day, 6 days a week, she would do calculations, very tedious, very hard calculations, because there was no computers. So she was not entrusted to do any kind of research or any kind of groundbreaking work, but that's what she did. So she discovered the period luminosity of Cepheid variable stars. So what does that mean? So as a star, a Cepheid variable is a type of star that pulsates radially, varying in both diameter and temperature, producing changes in brightness with a well-defined stable period and amplitude. A strong direct relationship between a Cepheid variable's luminosity and pulsation period established Cepheids as important indicator of cosmic benchmarks for scaling galactic and extragalactic distances. So once they learned more about a certain Cepheid variable in the Milky Way, then they saw another Cepheid variable. So that's C-E-P-H-E-I-D, Cepheid. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing correctly. Cepheid variable star. They knew how it behaved. So when they saw a Cepheid variable star in a faraway galaxy, from their luminosity, of course, the star would not be as luminous if it was far away. But because from the luminosity, I believe, they could establish the distance of that galaxy from our Milky Way. So the robust characteristics of classic Cepheids were discovered in 1908 by Henrietta Swan Leavitt after studying thousands of variable stars in the Magellanic Cloud. So there's a small and large Magellanic Cloud. They're dwarf galaxies that orbit our Milky Way. And I think they're 160,000 light years and 180,000 light years away, but they are being ripped apart from the gravitational tides of our Milky Way. And there's a thing called, something called a Magellanic Stream, where there's a stream of gas being siphoned off into the Milky Way. I believe that's what's happening. So this poor large Magellanic clouds, probably they don't have long to exist in terms of astronomical terms or astronomical years. So when the Milky Way will eventually rip them apart. So the discovery of classic Cepheid was discovered by Henrietta Swan Leavitt in 1908. And this discovery allows one to know the true luminosity of a Cepheid by simply observing its pulsation period. This in turn allows a person to determine the distance to the star by comparing its known luminosity to its observed brightness. The term Cepheid, so capital C-E-P-H-E-I-D, originates from Delta Cephei in the constellation Cephas, identified by John Goodrick in 1784, the first of its type to be so identified. So Annie, Loretta Swit did this stuff. She wasn't really tasked with this job. I believe she was tasked with being a human computer. But with all this data in front of her, she made her discoveries with this. So let's read on more about Henrietta Swan Leavitt. She was born as a daughter of a Congregational church minister. So I guess at those times, women weren't expected to go to university and study engineering or astronomy. I guess it was difficult for them to do so. And now women have role models like her and Annie Jump Cannon. But in 1892, she graduated from Harvard University's Radcliffe College. It was then known as Society for the Collegiate Instruction of Women. In 1893, she obtained credits towards a graduate degree in astronomy for work completed at the Harvard College Observatory. She never completed the degree, though. It was at the Harvard College Observatory that Leavitt began working as one of the women human computers hired by Edward Charles Pickering to measure and catalog the brightness of stars as they appeared on the observatory's photographic plate collection. In the early 1900s, women were not allowed to operate telescopes. Yeah, that's what I remember. They were not allowed to go and look through the telescopes. Only men could do that. Because Leavitt had independent means, Pickering initially did not have to pay her. Later, she received 30 cents an hour for her work, being paid only $10.50 per week. She was reportedly hardworking, seriously minded, little given to frivolous pursuits, and selflessly devoted to her family, her church, and her career. Pickering assigned Leavitt to study variable stars whose luminosity varies over time. So I think what happened at that time, she was asked to basically do calculations, not to come up with conclusions about them. According to science writer Jeremy Bernstein, variable stars had been of interest for years, but when she started studying the plates, I doubt Pickering thought she would make a significant discovery, one that would eventually change astronomy, end quote. Leavitt noted thousands of variable stars in images of the Magellanic Clouds. In 1908, she published her results in the Annals of the Astronomical Observatory of Harvard College, noting that a few of the variable stars showed a pattern. Bright ones appeared to have longer periods. After further study, she confirmed in 1912 that the Cepheid variables with greater intrinsic luminosity, they've had longer periods, and that the relationship was quite close and predictable. Leavitt used the simplifying assumption that all of the Cepheids within each Magellanic clouds were at approximately the same distance from Earth, so that their intrinsic brightness could be deduced from their apparent brightness as measured from the photographic plates and from the distance to each of the clouds. Since the variables are probably nearly the same distance from Earth, this is what she said, their periods are apparently associated with their actual emission of light as determined by their mass, density, and surface brightness, end quote. Pickering assigned her to the study of variable stars of the small and large Magellanic clouds recorded on photographic plates taken with the Bruce astrograph of the Boyden Station of Harvard Observatory at Arequipa, Peru. She identified 1,777 variable stars and discovered that the brighter ones had the larger period, a discovery known as the period luminosity relationship, or Leavitt's law. The logarithm of the period is linearly and directly related to the logarithm of the star's average intrinsic optical luminosity, which is the amount of power radiated by the star in the visible spectrum. In Leavitt's words, quote, a straight line can be readily drawn among each of the two series of points corresponding to maxima and minima, thus showing that there is a simple relation between the brightness of the Cepheid variables and their periods, end quote. Leavitt also developed and continued to refine the Harvard standard for photographic measurements, a logarithmic scale that orders stars by brightness over 17 magnitudes. She initially analyzed 299 plates from 13 telescopes to construct her scale, which was accepted by the International Committee of Photographic Magnitudes in 1913. So we have to think at that time, women were not tasked with doing this work. They were basically tasked with doing calculations. They weren't even allowed to use the telescopes. Only men could operate the telescopes. So I don't even think that they could look through the telescope. So she did amazing work, which I'll read this now. Her influence was the period luminosity relations for Cepheid variables made them the first standard candle in astronomy, allowing scientists to compute the distance to galaxies too remote for stellar parallax observations to be useful. So parallax is, you view something on when the Earth is on one side of its rotation period, then on the other side you measure the angle, and from that you can do trigonometry to calculate the distance. But things that are so far away, the Cepheid variables were the first standard candle in astronomy, allowing them to compute distances for faraway galaxies. 1 year after Leavitt reported her results, Ednar Hertzsprung determined the distance of several Cepheids in the Milky Way, and that, with his calibration, the distance to any Cepheid could be accurately determined. Cepheid variable stars were soon detected in other galaxies, such as Andromeda, notably by Edwin Hubble in 1923 and 24, and they became an important part of the evidence that spiral nebula are independent galaxies located far outside of our Milky Way. Thus, Leavitt's discovery would forever change our picture of the universe, as it prompted Harlow Shapley to move our sun from the center of the galaxy in the Great Debate, and Edwin Hubble to move our galaxy from the center of the universe. The accomplishments of Edwin Hubble, the American astronomer who established that the universe was expanding, was also made possible by Leavitt's groundbreaking research. Hubble often said that Leavitt deserved the Nobel Prize for his work. Gösta Mittag-Leffler of the Swedish Academy of Sciences tried to nominate her for that prize, only to learn she had died of cancer 3 years earlier. The Nobel Prize is not awarded posthumously. Her discovery of a way to accurately measure stellar distances on an intergalactic scale paved the way for modern astronomy's understanding for the scale and the structure of the universe. So I think today was an interesting show for me, very interesting, because talked more about the contributions of women in astronomy. And I talked today about Annie Jump Cannon and Henrietta Swan Leavitt. And as I promised before, I've been working on my website, www.marcosastrotalk.com. It's now finished. I have to clean it up a little. But other than that, you can go to it, and it looks beautiful. I made it myself because wonderful GoDaddy canceled my website. So now I made my own website, and I've I just did a show on women astronomers today, so I have something to contribute to my page on women in science. And I said a few years ago, I interviewed Trina Ray from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. She worked on the Cassini mission. I gave her a few weeks, because a few months actually, because her work ended in September, but it really didn't end. It was a lot of work. So I'm going to interview her soon, and we're going to learn more about the Cassini mission Saturn. So thank you for listening. This has been Astro Talk. You have been listening to Marco on CITR 101.9, and I hope everyone has a happy family day.